Hello. Once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 23 of our Disney bracket. This week, we will be discussing 1994's The Lion King, along with 1989's The Little Mermaid.
And hey, movies that are comparable. Yay!
Yeah, there's only a five-year difference between these two. Both are solidly within the Disney Renaissance.
Both have queer composers, so that's cool.
So, to recap our previous episodes, episode 12, we discussed The Lion King as well as Oliver and Company. We had a lot of things to talk about for Lion King, so I'm just going to give you the highlights. If you'd like more information, I highly recommend going and listening to that episode. So, highlights of our discussion were the weirdness of a predator as king of herbivore prey animals, the lackluster fight scenes towards the end of the film, the Mr. Pig scene with Pumbaa towards the finale is bad. Timon is really just an awful person. However, on the plus side, we have some really strong female characters in Nala, Shenzi, and Sarabi. There's some great foreshadowing of Mufasa's death, along with Simba having to fulfill his legacy. We talked quite a bit about Scar and various aspects of him from Jeremy Irons' portrayal and how that came to be, as well as his sort of foppish nature. We talked quite a bit about the voice cast, both the lack of people of color for a movie that takes place in Africa, but also the huge Broadway cast. And we also talked about some of the weird coding going on with the hyenas as both immigrants and outsiders, as well as fascists.
Meanwhile, in The Little Mermaid, I vented a lot of my feelings about the shallow feminist readings of Ariel's journey, and then we kind of unpacked the pros and cons of Ariel as a character and the writing of her as a teenager. We talked about Ursula quite a lot, as we should. We talked about how the art is kind of transitioning from the Dark Age to the Renaissance. We talked about how the structure doesn't really work. You can kind of get rid of one or two songs and the story would probably flow better if you put something else there. And we talked about how there's some heavy-handed metaphors. I feel like the best place to start is how Lion King also has a heavy-handed metaphor, by which I mean Simba puts his foot into the heavy hand of his father's footprint.
I mean, I love that scene.
Yeah.
It's only on screen for maybe 5 seconds.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the reason I don't mind it nearly as much. But I will admit, it is a bit hypocritical for me to love that scene, but hate Ariel feeling trapped.
And you're not wrong. The footprint thing is probably a more interesting visual than I feel trapped, so I'm visually trapped. But this is right after Oliver and Company, and Oliver and Company didn't really have any kind of visual metaphors like that. This is kind of the first artistic movie they're doing in decades. A lot of the stuff that is, you know, ostensibly artistic, like visual metaphors, are a lot less complex, maybe. And it's kind of like the difference between dinosaur animatronics in Jurassic Park versus Jurassic Park 3, where they have animatronics that can dive into the water and that kind of thing.
Hmm. I think another issue I had with the Little Mermaid metaphors that I didn't have with the Lion King ones is that when the Lion King is using those sorts of metaphors, it's not also singing about them during them happening.
True.
Where the Little Mermaid definitely does that, and it kind of just hammers it home.
Yeah. There's another one I want to bring up, though, with Little Mermaid that I think is kind of clever. So because Ursula is this vast presence, she has all her tentacles, they can really use that to make her fill the space she's in, literally and visually. So you'll see her dominating the space around Ariel, making Ariel seem comparatively smaller and trapped, which is a really cool thing for when they're hanging out for poor unfortunate souls. And there's this one really cool bit where Ursula is trying to convince Ariel to go in for a thing, and the camera's close up on her while she's doing her lipstick, and she's not only dominating the frame and kind of trapping Ariel into the space, but also she turns and she's literally two-faced because she's, you know, presenting a sweet deal when also she's working with something behind the scenes. That was more clever, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, the way Ursula's tentacles are animated throughout the entire film is incredibly fluid. They're really well done.
Tentacles as a way to have a character express emotion is really cool, and we rarely see it. You get, like, Ursula and Davy Jones from Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and 3, and that's about it. will curl around like a mustache, basically, when she's thinking, I'm going to take over the kingdom. I'm not sure what that accent was. Or they'll like clench up when she's angry, and it's really cool looking.
And while I complained about Little Mermaid's very heavy-handed metaphors, nothing tops the Ace of Hearts scene from Hunchback of Notre Dame. Nothing in this bracket is worse than that. Metaphor-wise, anyway.
I do want to say a little bit more about the art in Little Mermaid, because it's coming right off of Oliver and Company. There's a lot of really pretty stuff in it, and I know they put a lot of work into some of the human stuff, especially the ship and the surface and all the stuff in Ariel's grotto. And especially when Ariel pops up and you have all the fireworks going off for the prince's birthday and beautiful lighting effects playing out on the skin. And I'm like, you know, I get it. I see why she'd be enchanted. How could she not be? And imagining seeing this, if you've never seen anything like this before in terms of animation up on a big screen in a theater, that must have been stellar.
I would actually disagree, because they have two very distinct color palettes for everything above the water and everything below, and it actually remains consistent for sunken objects. Everything that comes from the human world has a lot more grays and browns and is just dingier. You can especially see this in the opening scene with how dark the water is, cloudy the sky, the dolphins and seagulls flying around aren't very saturated, they're pretty muted. But then as you go down under the sea, under the sea, and you see Atlantica, you have all these bright saturated colors or these pastels. There's just a lot more variety of color. And even with Ursula's lair, where they're trying to make it dark and foreboding, they do that with these dark purples contrasted with these pinks and fuchsias.
You're not wrong. The color is definitely, there is more vibrancy under the sea. Under the sea! But in terms of physical objects in the world, there's a lot more things in the human world. The underwater world feels kind of stark. Sure, they have buildings in Atlantica, but I feel like there weren't as many objects in them. But you're right, the colors are better down where it's wetter. I keep putting myself in that position. One more thing that's weird to me. We talked a lot about how bad the boat from Pocahontas is, and the boat looks better here in the movie made 10 years before that. How do you mess that up? How do you go backwards?
In fairness, it wasn't quite 10 years. It was closer to Pocahontas was 95, 96.
Yeah, it was in 1995, so I guess only about 5 years. Still, they went backwards with the animation somehow.
Yeah, and if you're looking closely enough, you can obviously tell that the boat at the beginning is computer generated.
But it doesn't stand out as being awful the way the stairs do.
Yes. Speaking about art styles, we talked a little bit about this in a previous episode, but Lion King has pretty varied styles for when it animates animals. Towards the beginning of the film, you have this very photorealistic look, and things that they're doing with the camera angles and framing give it almost this sort of nature documentary, National Geographic sort of vibe. Probably the best example of this is the scene where in the foreground you have the ants carrying the leaves along the branch, and then in the background you have the zebra's herd marching forward, and it shifts focus between the two like a camera would.
So cool looking.
But then later on in the film, the best example is Just Can't Wait to Be King. A lot of the animals are very cartoon-esque and much more reminiscent of Disney's house style.
It's almost like you're being led into the world. You start off in our understanding of the savannah's wildlife, and then we transition into a world where there are characters. I also do love how in Just Can't Wait to Be King, Simba jumps down. We actually see the art shift out from where his feet land to from relatively photorealistic to this vibrant psychedelic world. Mm-hmm. It's just a cool little synchronicity of visual and sound.
Especially since it starts off with that heavy percussion.
Yeah.
Well, since we're talking about songs, let's go ahead and talk about them. Both of these films have a very similar musical structure.
Mm-hmm. Also, both of them had several songs nominated for or winning Oscars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so they both have an introduction to the world song. They have an I Want song, so part of your world, I just can't wait to be king. They get a villain song, Poor Unfortunate Souls, and Be Prepared. They get a kind of chill, happy song.
Feel good.
Yeah, a feel good song with Under the Sea and Hakuna Matata, and a love song with Kiss the Girl and Can You Feel the Love Tonight?
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the introductory song for Little Mermaid is kind of just this sea shanty at the beginning that's not very memorable.
I'll tell you a tale of the bottomless blue and its hay to the starboard heave ho. So come, Madam Mermaid, be waiting for you in mysterious fathoms below.
And then the presenting Ariel song, it's kind of nothing.
Yeah. And that's compared with Circle of Life, which is probably one of the best Disney openings ever.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's already doing so well, then, like, it closes off the entire card goes. Yeah, so it's kind of not fair to compare those openings, but how about the I Want songs?
I think, as far as, like, the I Want songs, Part of Your World gives us a much better understanding of Ariel as a character than Can't Wait to Be King does of Simba, specifically because there's such a drastic change between Simba when he's singing that song and Simba when he is actually completing his character arc and goes through quite a bit of drastic change from realizing that there are much more complexities of being king than he first realized to the death of his father and betrayal by Scar, running out into the desert, almost dying, being adopted by
Nathan Lane and his boyfriend.
Yes. And then having to be convinced to come back and right the wrongs that his uncle committed. There's a huge change in character, and we don't really get a song that really dives into Simba's internal state through all of that. I'm not sure we need one. I don't think that's necessarily a flaw with the film, but it does make Can't Wait to Be King and Part of Your World very different songs structurally.
And I'm going to go to bat for Part of Your World if only because it's a very queer song and it gives me a lot of feels. But on the other hand, just Can't Wait to Be King is a hella bop. They both have a lot to recommend for them.
Yeah. Although I do have some problems with Part of Your World because it seriously calls into question just how much Ariel actually knows about humans.
Right. Although I think that actually kind of works for her being naive. Like, her naivete is what drives a lot of the plot, and I'm okay with that. That's a character trait.
There's this line talking about how Ariel believes that up on the surface world they don't reprimand their daughters, which, oh, honey, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Little Mermaid 2, Ariel versus the patriarchy.
But that line is very in character for a 16-year-old just wanting to get away from her restrictive parent.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's also important for understanding the complexity of her motivations, that the human world is also an escape because fish can't go there.
Yeah.
Is it kind of like a toss-up there for these two?
I mean, I definitely give it to Part of Your World. I think it has a stronger place in the narrative than Can't Wait to Be King.
Sure. How about Poor Unfortunate Souls versus Be Prepared?
I love the rhymes in Be Prepared, if nothing else. They're so good.
A shining new era is tiptoeing nearer.
And where do we feature?
Just listen to teacher. Yeah.
I know it sounds sordid, but you'll be rewarded.
It does have some really good rhymes. On the flip side, Poor Unfortunate Souls, I think, doing more narrative work. Be Prepared is really just Scar declaring his intent to take over the Pride Lands, which he did from the first line of the movie. Whereas Poor Fortunate Souls, we see Ursula convincing Ariel to do the thing, her agreeing to do the thing, setting up the terms and clauses of that thing, and then it happening. Also, I'm not sure like what musical stylings I prefer, the rich baritone to Be Prepared or the ridiculous melodrama of Poor Fortunate Souls.
I mean, on that front, I definitely give it to Be Prepared. Jeremy Irons is doing a bang-up job. There is a portion of the song where his voice had given out and Jim Cummings, who voices Ed in the film, actually had to step in. Jim Cummings has also voiced Scar in a lot of superfluous Lion King stuff, like he voiced Scar in the Kingdom Hearts games.
Sure.
And I can tell when the voice switches, but it's very subtle. You'd only notice it if you were paying attention. And I think it's kind of impressive what they do there.
Yeah, I'll give you that one. I guess it also has the narrative work of convincing the hyenas to abandon anarchism for fascism.
Yeah, they had such a good premise.
Great idea! Who needs a king? No king, no king, la 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 la!
I think Beaker Parrot is maybe slightly stronger, but like only by a hair's breadth.
Yeah, like they're both good songs, yeah. But I mean, I think more people also can sing along to Be Prepared than Poor Unfortunate Souls.
With that attitude.
In the circles I run in.
Sure.
I mean, I know Ursula's queer icon, so.
Yes. Although, Scar's not far behind, honestly. Let's be real.
Oh, I shall practice my curtsy.
So, Hakuna Matata versus Under the Sea.
Under the Sea!
Which, we didn't talk about it last time, but the problematic racial stuff with Sebastian kind of comes to a head. It's Under the Sea.
Under the Sea!
I think from a musical standpoint, Under the Sea...
Under the Sea!
...is probably stronger. It's a little bit more complex, a little bit more upbeat. I think it flows better than Hakuna Matata does.
The visuals are maybe more exciting. I like that they try to figure out what you can make an instrument out of underwater, like using the octopus tentacles as a string instrument. On the flip side, we already kind of know Sebastian's point of view, whereas with Hakuna Matata, we're learning about Timon and Pumbaa as characters.
That's very true. And learning about Timon and Pumbaa is important because when Destiny finally comes calling for Simba, he shares their worldview at that point. So understanding them is understanding him and understanding the conflict that he goes through when he is faced with the decision to go home and fix things or not. So to the narrative and structure of the movie, Hakuna Matata is, I believe, more important.
Yeah. Although I think Under the Sea is...
Under the Sea!
...is a better song overall, so kind of I can go out of the way here.
Yeah. Again, it's a real close toss-up. I think Hakuna Matata is going to edge it out for me just a little bit.
Sure. And lastly, Kiss the Girl versus Can You Feel the Love Tonight? I will say before anything else happens, Can You Feel the Love Tonight opens and ends with Nathan Lane, who is a delightful man, but his singing voice is perhaps more grating here than delightful.
They'll fall in love, and here's the bottom line. Our trio's down to two.
But, yeah.
However, the middle is filled with the velvety smooth stylings of Elton John.
That's true.
And then there's also some interstitial sung dialogue from Simba and Nala.
And those are really useful for getting their internal states.
I think Can You Feel the Love Tonight kind of pulls double duty in that respect, where it's a love song, but it's also giving us what Just Can't Wait to the King didn't before, and giving us this understanding of the internal states of Simba and Nala and why they're at odds with one another and how to proceed with the information that, oh, hey, Simba is alive, or, oh, hey, the Pride Lands have kind of gone to shit.
On the flip side, Kiss the Girl has a really good, I guess, energetic arc to it. Can You Feel the Love Tonight is, you know, nice and pretty, but Kiss the Girl builds really well.
Yeah, although there's that awful false start with Scuttle.
That's true. And Eric is like,
somebody should find that poor animal and put it out of its misery.
Ariel doesn't disagree.
I mean, would anyone?
As the scuttle of our friend group, I'm like, no, you're right. But although I know people have read it as advocating non-consent stuff, so that's not great. I don't think it means to be. In the situation, it's legitimate, but in other situations, a girl not being able to say yes doesn't equal yes.
Yeah. Context is very important in this case. Whereas Can You Feel the Love Tonight doesn't have those same issues of consent. The title of the song is literally asking a question. Can you feel it? Do you want to proceed?
Kiss the Girl is also a very chaste song. Like, you could play that at like a junior high prom. Whereas Can You Feel the Love Tonight is about fucking.
It is. It's during that song where we get the Nala bedroom eye scene.
Yeah, that they just hold that face for a while.
I'm sure lots of children felt very strange feelings during that scene.
POV Khajiit sex. .mp4. So where are we following with this one, you think?
I know we've been kind of favoring Lion King, but I really do think that Can You Feel the Love Tonight is a significant step above Kiss the Girl.
Sure.
They're both good songs, but
yeah. So, including Circle of Life, that means that the score is 1 to Little Mermaid and 4 to Lion King.
And two of those that Lion King have could have very easily gone either way.
Yeah, honestly, I probably should have fought harder for Poor Unfortunate Souls, but I didn't. So, here we are. Also Jeremy Irons.
They're tough calls.
Yeah.
If you disagree with us, let us know.
Yeah. Oh, actually, there is one more song that happens. Scar and Zazu have a song together where they're singing,
I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts.
And it's a really weirdly charming scene because I'm sure they hate each other for many reasons. Zazu's locked in a cage, a rib cage, and Scar took over the Pride Lands and killed Mufasa. But they still find this common ground of having a lovely bunch of coconuts, and it's a really weirdly charming scene that they're both kind of having fun with it, and it makes Scar a much more complex character, just in that he can actually experience joy in things that aren't,
my evil plan!
I mean, he has Zazu locked up and is coercing him into singing it via threat of, I will eat you if you don't.
Yeah, that is pretty, my evil plan-ish.
And we could also pretty easily compare that song to either Ursula's little song while she is in the dressing room of the ship before the wedding.
Oh, the embarrassing explaining my whole plan song?
Yes, that one. Which is maybe 30 seconds long. It's barely a song.
Yeah.
Or we can compare it to La Poisson.
Oh, God.
In the kitchen with the chef.
Wow. I forgot about La Poisson because during that I was like, I don't care. And I switched back to brushing up my sign language. Ariel is,
The listeners at home can't see that.
Oh, right.
But yeah, that whole scene in La Poisson and the surrounding bits in the kitchen are completely unnecessary. We talked about this in the previous episode, but they waste so much time trying to set up the chef as the secondary antagonist to Sebastian, and the film doesn't need it. You could have spent that in much better places. You could have spent that with more Ariel and Eric getting to know each other. You could have spent that more with Ursula plotting against them. You could have even went back to Atlantica and figured out how Triton's doing now that his daughter is gone and missing for a significant period of time.
Or better still, how the sisters feel. The sisters get nothing in that movie.
Yeah.
They're even animated less well than everybody else.
Yeah, there's the song of Ariel's debut where she doesn't show up, and then telling, oh, Daddy, you're so thick, she's in love. And then they're gone until the wedding where they're background characters. We could talk about the symbolism of Mufasa and his song.
I mean, I made that pun first. I don't have any right to groan at it, but I will anyway. Play the music.
So we talked about Simba and the divine right of kings in our previous episode, but on the second watch through, I noticed it kind of goes a little bit further than that, and Simba's set up as almost this messianic figure, and they constantly associate Simba with the sky. The first instance of this is after the opening sequence, Circle of Life, the presentation of Simba, and then Mufasa confronting Scar for not showing up. Rain falls, and they give us a few shots around the Pride Lands, showing the storm, and then we move on to Rafiki and his tree, where he's doing the drawing of Simba and establishing all of that. And then we have the scene with Mufasa talking about the great kings of the past looked down on us from the stars. And there's also the fact that whenever Simba is in the most danger, we can't see the sky. Either it's because they're in the elephant graveyard and the geography is obfuscating it along with this fog, and they're kind of in this labyrinthine cave structure in the gorge where the stampede has kicked up so much dust that we can't see what's going on, and the sky is almost blotted out. And then in the confrontation with Scar after the lightning strikes and the fire starts, everything is filled with smoke, and these are all of the most dangerous points for Simba in the narrative.
You can also draw a comparison between Pride Rock, how it's this giant rock outcropping in a flat plain, to things like Stonehenge or Göbekli Tepe, where you have these highly ceremonial stone places that are associated with astronomical things, probably.
You could also very easily compare it to Mount Olympus.
Yeah.
There are quite a few similarities between Simba and other sky-focused deities like Zeus or Odin. Throughout the film, Simba is almost literally solar-powered. We have the sunrise scene where he's being presented as the crown prince after his birth. And then when Simba is returning to the Pride Lands from the jungle, where the sun is kind of blotted out by the canopy because of how big the trees are, they specifically have this short scene where Simba is running across the desert, and they have a short clip of just staring at the sun in the sky and then panning down to Simba. They want you to associate Simba with the sky and with the sun and with light.
Which plays in pretty well to the whole circle of life thing. As we know, the sun also rises and sets, and we have Mufasa's lines about how,
"One day, Simba, the sun will set on my time here and will rise with you as the new king."
And I think you notice when he dies, we then have the sunset happening right after that.
Yeah, after Mufasa dies, we do not see the Pride Lands lit again until after Scar is defeated and Simba takes the throne.
There must always be a Stark in Winterfell, basically.
Mm-hmm. There's also the fact that, like, circle of life can literally mean the sun. It is a circle, and it is the source of all life on the planet.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird mashup, though, because, I mean, the Divine Right of King is a very Christian concept, and that's a very linear thing. You have the universe started, you know, like God made things, the universe will keep going, and then eventually it will end. Whereas the circle of life just sort of keeps going. It doesn't necessarily have that, a beginning or an end point. There's just the grass, the antelopes, the lion, the dirt, the grass, the antelopes, just sort of, there's not necessarily a beginning to that circle. And I'm not saying that makes it bad per se, but it does make the metaphors kind of messy if you dig into them too far. They're kind of pulling from all these different things that don't all necessarily meld well together.
Yeah. There's kind of this insinuation that the lions are the most important part of the circle, and if they're out of whack, everything else falls. But that could easily be the same thing for the grass or the antelopes. It's not the best metaphor, but I think it is interesting.
And I have to admit that, for whatever reason, a lot of the Simba, you have to go be king now, things hit me really hard in ways I don't fully understand. It just really works. The emotions just go.
This kind of gets into another kind of comparison point that we can make between these two films, is there's the scale of the conflict and how it's portrayed. Lion King, we have this very mythological, Shakespearean, Arthurian level of conflict and drama going on, and that's how it's presented to us. Where the conflict in Little Mermaid, while not necessarily any smaller, it's still about a evil person attempting to usurp the throne from a quote-unquote just leader. But the way that everything is framed in The Little Mermaid is much more Victorian.
You have the pining lovers, the scheming relatives, and the various attendants who are trying and failing to help.
I think a lot of what it comes down to is how direct or indirect the machinations of the villain are. Scar is much more direct with how he is attempting to gain control of the Pride Lands, whereas Ursula is a little bit more subtle and a little bit more manipulating.
She's using, like, legal drama as opposed to a murder. Essentially, the conflicts are basically the same amount of tension that a kingdom could be lost to a totalitarian ruler, but for whatever reason, Lion King succeeds in presenting it as this epic conflict, whereas Little Mermaid feels more pulp.
I think another part of that is that we honestly don't spend that much time getting to know Atlantica, whereas a huge portion of The Lion King is specifically introducing us to the concept of what the Pride Lands is like and how it functions and why it's important.
And it's weird because we spend a lot of time in the undersea part of the world. We don't really get to the human world for almost 2/3 of the film. At least not the human world proper, where Ariel's, you know, walking on legs. But we don't get a sense for what the world is about down there. Just, it exists.
I think part of that is just how much of an outsider Ariel is to all of it. She is constantly trying to escape, so we don't see what she's exactly trying to escape from besides her father.
Right, which is reasonable. I think it's cool about Lion King, though. It's one of the only Disney films with a monarchic thing that presents any other option. We mentioned this earlier, that the hyenas are like, who needs a king? And Timon and Pumbaa are also kind of unconcerned with governmental structures. They just do whatever. And most of these films don't really do that. It's just somebody trying to be the king. Whereas in Lion King, someone says, we don't actually have to do that. This is fine without. We don't need anybody to rule this.
We got like a teeny bit of that in Wreck-It Ralph. But yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. And that's also a throwaway gag.
Exactly. I think another reason that Little Mermaid feels so Victorian in comparison to The Lion King is that on a certain level, it's just the story of the sexual awakening of a 16-year-old mermaid.
Pretty much. And I'm fine with that, honestly. I'm okay with having a child's sexual awakening slash coming of age being this grand epic thing. That can be what it feels like when you're that age. That literally the fate of the world hanging in the balance of you getting your man. And I know a lot of people have problems with Ariel's growth analyzed from a sort of standard feminist lens, but a lot of queer feminists had different thoughts on that. We didn't get into it last time because I hadn't really done the homework, but my friend, the unsinkable Jade Metzger Rifkin, sent me this really great article by Leland G. Spencer, where the film is analyzed through traditional queer lenses and is unpacked as various beats that you see in many trans teenagers coming of age and realizing, exploring, announcing, and coming to terms with their identity in their gender presentation. You know, that's an interesting read. So I started digging into it. And there's a lot of people who have written about how, as trans people, they relate really well to the film, which, I mean, I get that. And there's also an article by Joss Truitt, who also wrote My Auntie Buffalo Bill, which is an amazing piece of queer film criticism about Silence of the Lambs. And I love it, and I was so excited to see that the same author has both of these pieces. Writes about how Little Mermaid is definitely problematic in various ways, but it hits a lot of those touchstones of these things that you kind of have to go through as a trans person that are unique in coming of age. And honestly, if you take away the mermaid bits, it is basically the standard low budget trans coming of age story. A girl has an identity that she's very interested in, that she's keeping away from her family, but she's hoarding all of the stuff that allows expression of that identity. Her family finds out and gets angry, and she runs away, falls in with a bad crowd, does eventually find a happy ending, and her parents realize that she's happier that way. That's basically every given queer coming of age story ever.
Yeah, that's like 90% of the queer movies on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. The ones that aren't, well, this mere sex turned to something more. Yes, it always will. And Tangerine. I think analyzing Little Mermaid through a trans lens, kind of like analyzing it through a racial lens, it can only get you so far because it's not a one-to-one parallel, but it definitely has ways that you can, I guess, gain inspiration or resonance from it, even if it's unintentional in some ways. This is a really minor thing that kind of serves as a bridge to the next point, but when Nala and Simba are fighting, when they first meet, I'm like, that's familiar. What is it about this framing? And then I realize they're mocking the T-Rex King Kong fight from the original King Kong, with Timon standing in for the blonde lady screaming on the branch while in the background the two titans are fighting. And it's a really cool homage, but it isn't super obvious. And I'm like, wow, that's a really nicely done. It even ends with one being pinned. Oh, also, speaking of, I guess, cool homages, this is a bad transition, I'm sorry. I like how Ursula uses fishing metaphors to talk about the people she's trying to have power over. She talks about how
he is quite a catch, isn't he?
And she has tried,
I'll see him wriggle like a worm on a hook.
Which is just kind of a subtle way to reinforce that she's part of this predatory ideology that the sea people are afraid of.
I get that, but also now that you mention it, Ursula is a character that is very queer-coded, and specifically coded very much akin to a drag queen. Her design was based off of Divine. So there is some unfortunate parallels there with catfishing, like online.
I can see that.
It's not the strongest thing, but I figured I'd mention it. Speaking of interesting little things that the villains do, towards the climax of The Lion King, when Scar is being questioned by Sarabi about why can't we just leave the Pride Lands, and he's like,
we're not going anywhere.
Then you have sentenced us to death.
Then so be it.
And she's like,
you can't do that.
And he says,
I am a king. I can do whatever I want.
And it's really interesting to see Scar's understanding of the responsibilities and powers of monarchy in this moment are exactly the same as Simba before any of the lessons from his father. And how far removed Simba is from that understanding of the responsibilities of leadership.
Although, there's a part of me that has a little pity for Scar. I get the idea that their dad was grooming Mufasa to be king from the beginning because he's, you know, the rightful heir. But he doesn't seem to have, I guess, done anything for Scar to get him ready for his passing and his role in things afterwards. You don't need two princes. You need one prince. At one point, Scar is just like the spare. And there's a draft of a song that you can find online pretty easily from Frozen where Anna sings about her anxiety about being the spare because her sister's going to be the queen and what does that make her? And she is trying to figure out what her identity is beyond just the spare princess. And Scar kind of has the same thing. He doesn't really have a role beyond being the sassy uncle. Where does Scar fit into the circle of life?
And he could have very easily fit in as an ambassador to other kingdoms, like could have been an ambassador to the hyenas. That may not have necessarily prevented everything that happened in this film, but it would have at least given Scar somewhat more of a purpose. He could have also easily filled Zazu's role. He probably would have done a better job than Zazu, even though he can't get around as easily because no wings.
Question, who has better sassy one-liners, Zazu or Scar?
Oh, Scar, obviously.
Okay.
Zazu is just such a nerd.
Yes. Yeah, he's basically like John Oliver if he was a bird. Every time I hear it, it makes me laugh when he's giving the morning report. I love it. Where he's talking about how...
Well, the buzz from the bees is that the leopards are in a bit of a spot. I told the elephants to forget it, but they can't.
Oh, good. You're talking about just his dialogue and not the awful song that did not need to be added to the film. The morning report.
Oh, yeah, no. I don't know what I was doing there. Stop adding songs, Disney. Except Evermore. That was okay. Oh, one more thing. I'm looking at my notes right now, and I've got all the small points hit, but if you look at them, you can see that I've written Kill Flounder in huge font. Where Lion King succeeds and Little Mermaid fails is that Lion King has a real gravitas for a lot of things, and Little Mermaid tries, but it has too many comical characters like Flounder and Scuttle and to a certain extent Sebastian that are...
superfluous?
Yeah, they definitely serve a role in the story, but you could remove Flounder and tell the story pretty well and be okay, and you might have more weight to scenes. You wouldn't need Ariel to have kind of this wacky buddy. She could be more isolated, and that would work better for her as a character.
So, sarcasm incoming, but if you remove Flounder, then who would have surprised Ariel with the statue of Eric in her grotto? The small fish who got that huge statue there through that small door. He doesn't even have thumbs.
My theory is that, like, the boat happened to, like, break apart right over the hole that she can't fit through, and the statue floated down through there.
How does the statue fit through the hole that Ariel can't fit through?
Well, you see...
Yeah, Flounder sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, the statue doesn't make a lot of sense. Maybe he carved it himself?
He just have thumbs. I think we're getting a little slap happy. I think it's time to call it.
Yeah. I think Lion King is a better film, even if I do have a huge special place in my heart for Little Mermaid.
I also agree that The Lion King is a better film, and I didn't even want The Little Mermaid to move past round one. And it's not a bad film, it's just... it's really not my thing, and I can see a lot of the structural issues the film has. Maybe if Disney decides to do a reboot of this, it'll be better.
Oh, they are.
Oh, okay.
That's like in the docket.
Yeah, but there's lots of things in the docket that we haven't seen anything from.
That's fair. I think a live-action treatment will be really fun for this. It could do some tightening up that those ones get sometimes.
Yeah, I think this deserved it much more than something like Mulan or Beauty and the Beast. I think those films stand on their own pretty well, whereas this one, it shows all its cracks and wrinkles.
Also, the musical is really good, and they could pull some songs from that if they wanted to fluff things up. Also, can you imagine the visuals with our current technology rendering, like, Atlantica?
Oh, yeah. I would imagine it would be something akin to Pandora from the Avatar films, just underwater.
So, Lion King is moving on, and Ariel must give up and return to the sea.
I would say the Little Mermaid has been silenced.
Oh, come on. Come on, man. Come on. What's up next week?
We have the matchup everyone's been waiting for. Chicken Little versus Tangled.
Wow, that's the last episode of round two.
It is.
I know.
It's a momentous occasion, but
is it?
I mean, last episode of round two, I would say that's a momentous occasion.
That's true. Thanks for joining us, and we hope to see you next week. If you liked it, tell us what you thought. Do the whole spreading to your friends.
You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. You can also follow us right here on Podbean. Once again, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. We hope you tune in next week.